Like many cities, Milwaukee attracted a lot of people because of its proximity to water. And we'll explore that connection with our guest today, Larry Mueller here. My guest, John Gerda, joining us by phone today. Very well-known Milwaukee historian, the author of 22 books, including histories of Milwaukee area neighborhoods, industries, places of worship. John's also a lecturer. He's a tour guide, local history columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And his latest book, which I found fascinating, is titled Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. So what's your relationship to the water around Milwaukee? How's it changed over the years for you? What would you like to know about the history of Milwaukee in relation to water? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And as I said, John Gerda with us by phone. Hey, John, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Glad to be here, Larry.
Usually a television special is made from a book, but in the case of this book, it was the other way around. How'd that happen?
It was backwards. Actually, this began as a lecture about 6-7 years ago, and then we did a one-hour documentary for Milwaukee PBS that still streams 24/7. You can just look up Milwaukee City Built on Water, and you can tune in at your convenience. And then the Wisconsin Historical Society Press approached me and said, can you turn this into a book? And I said, it's only a 7,500-word script. But it turned out, water, as you know, is very hot these days. It's a very hot topic. Yeah. So there was a lot to cover, a lot of waterfront to cover. So I ended up turning a 7,500-word script into about a 45,000-word book that was just out about not even 2 months ago.
Yeah, and it's a great book. I mean, you know, I've spent time in Milwaukee. I've never lived in Milwaukee, but I tell you, reading the book really, to me, was eye-opening and really interesting. And I think anybody, no matter where you live, you're going to find the story of Milwaukee and its relationship to water a fascinating one. I really enjoyed reading it. And the photography and so forth is absolutely wonderful.
No, it was nicely produced. Had a great designer, Jim Price, and a wonderful contemporary photographer, Chris Winters, who really made my words look good.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, they did a wonderful job, and you did a wonderful job. And if you don't know Milwaukee, I think, you know, you might think that, well, it's Lake Michigan, and that's what caused it. But the water, the other water, really helped build that city as well.
Certainly. It's a real complex of forces there. And today, any of the coastal cities from Kenosha all the way up to Gills Rock or Bayfield, you think of the water as kind of a backdrop, a source of drinking water, source of weather. But in the case of all these towns, in the days before not even railroads, the days before roads, it was water that brought people to this part of the entire world. So Milwaukee happened to have the best natural harbor on the western shore of Lake Michigan, which is why it exists. So today it's somewhat taken for granted, but that was a highway that got people to Milwaukee. And once they got here, once they got to Milwaukee, water certainly helped to determine what they did. You had water power on the Menominee and the Milwaukee rivers that drove the city's first industries, and it carries through things like beer. You know, what do you do? Water is more than 90% of the ingredients of beer, so you had to have a source of good, clean, fresh, and abundant water for Milwaukee's most famous product. And the other kind of, it's not even a metaphor, built on water is literally true. Much of Milwaukee's downtown, Menominee Valley, Third Ward, Walker's Point, Bayview, most of those areas exist on landfill, or as they was made land. You know, they would they would take gravel from the bluffs around the Milwaukee area. The term they used was borrowed. They borrowed that gravel. They didn't return it. You know, all that gravel got kind of pushed down, and then you had a lot of additives, including you know, refuse of meat shops and cinders from the incinerators. You know, it was. Sort of brownfield, but that made a lot of what is Milwaukee's land today. Yeah. The lakefront, Lincoln Memorial Drive, that's all landfill. So,
yeah, there you go.
True, literally.
Pat in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hi. So I grew up in Bayview, and I worked summers in the Jones Island wastewater treatment plant in the laboratory. And my dad was a machinist there, and he spent a number of days at a time when a pumping station that is now Collectivo Coffee would break down. And they have an exhibit down there, which I love to visit. They've kind of gotten they've removed the tools that got used to maintain the pumps, and there was a panel in the floor of probably very thick plexiglass or something where you could look down and see the water still rushing under the building, and now that's gone too. But I thought that was a really cool exhibit. I'd love to go there and kind of, you know, just kind of reminisce about my days when I worked there and my dad was in that building. And I just had a great time growing up on Lake Michigan, cliff jumping in St. Francis and swimming in the lake and all of that.
Well,
no, it's a great landmark where Collectivo Coffee is now. And that's for readers who don't, or listeners who don't know quite where that is. It's on Lincoln Memorial Drive, about halfway between the north and the south ends. And what was going on then was the Milwaukee River, like almost all the urban rivers in the Midwest, was an open sewer. And that is not a metaphor. There was a line I quote in the book from a visitor who came back in 1881 who called the Milwaukee River a currentless and yellowish murky stream with water like oil and an odor combined of the effluvia of 100 sewers.
And that's
really
kind of
not lunchtime, you know, sort of descriptions. So what they did was, and where that the tunnel came from or the facility came from, is they dug a tunnel under the east side and in what's now Collectivo Coffee, put the largest water pump in the whole world at the time, which is still there. And you're right. You know, the plexiglass viewing panel is removed, but the pump's still there and still operative. And they used the fresh lake water to flush, literally, the Putrid River. So it cleaned out the river and made downtown smell like something better than a sewer. But where did all that water go? It goes all the way out to the lake, and that's your drinking water. So long before anybody could even spell cryptosporidium, you had these outbreaks of what they called intestinal flu, which was typhoid fever, and people were dying of what you think of as kind of a third-world health problem today, but was really part of anyone who used the Great Lakes for groundwater, for surface water, was absolutely at risk. So, yeah, I've said that the it's ironic that you have this upscale coffee house that was built originally to move a little murkier liquid.
There you go. And, you know, in mentioning Jones Island, you've got a whole chapter in your book on Jones Island.
Oh, it's fascinating. I actually did my master's thesis on Jones Island back in geography school at UWM. And if there's one area that has seen more change and is more a microcosm of the Milwaukee's and Wisconsin's history, I'm not aware of it. That was a Native American settlement. It was a fur trading post. It was a shipyard run by a guy named Jones, which is where the name comes from. And it was from the 1870s to the 1920s, it was the largest commercial fishing village in Wisconsin. There were about 1,600 people who lived there, largely from the Polish seacoast. The Baltic Sea coast of Poland, a group called the Kashubes, and they would bring up something like 2 million pounds of fish in a typical year. So that was a really essential source of protein for southeastern Wisconsin. And they lived pretty much as squatters. They paid taxes on their personal property, but not in their homes. It was, I described it as an improvised settlement, and it really was very picturesque, but also very, very rustic. And then it was condemned in 1914 when the city needed both an outer harbor because the boats were getting too big to use the rivers and the sewage treatment plant. A previous caller talked about where she worked in summers. That was built in 1925. And then Milwaukee, after being years kind of behind the pack, kind of vaulted ahead and had the most advanced and largest, the term they used, or the methodology, was activated sludge, the largest plant of its kind in the entire world. People would come from Europe to find out how Milwaukee did it. So it's had it's had a lot of lives, an awful lot of lives.
Oh, it surely has. Our guest today is John Gerda. He is the author of 22 books, including Histories of Milwaukee Area Neighborhoods, Industries, and Places of Worship. His latest is called Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. I'd love to hear from you. And David in Glendale, I hope you'll stay on. David's got some comments and questions as well. What about you? Again, 1-800-642-1234. We are going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back with John Gerda to talk about more about Milwaukee, a city built on water. Stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. Taking a look at the influence of water on the city of Milwaukee. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Milwaukee historian John Gerda. He's the author of many books, including histories of Milwaukee area neighborhoods, industries, places of worship. And his latest is titled Milwaukee, a City Built on Water. So, what are your favorite places to enjoy water in Milwaukee? What questions about Milwaukee's history? I hope you'll become a part of our conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. And, John, we have David from Glendale who's been waiting a bit. So, let's just go right to David. David, thank you so much for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, I first want to say how lucky we are to have John Gerda.
Oh, for sure.
Well, thank you.
For sharing all this history. I live close to Lincoln Park, and like the city of Milwaukee, Lincoln Park is a place where waters come together. The Lincoln Creek and the Milwaukee River flow together. And now that the Estabrook Dam has been removed, it's not a great place for power boating anymore, but it's fantastic for kayaking and canoeing. And I just wanted to let people know that a lot more people are coming there. There are four islands you can paddle around and explore. There's an east channel with a beaver lodge, and you can see herons and hawks and turtles, and almost like being another 100 miles north.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perhaps even more, Dave. And I know that it's not as widely sung as it should be, but we've got the Milwaukee River Greenway in Milwaukee, you know, that runs, you know, up to Lincoln Park beyond, but it's mostly the area, it's Capitol Drive down to North Avenue. And that's about, it includes Lincoln as well. I think there's about 900 acres and I think about 6 miles of shoreline, and it's there are formal paths on the east side when you get closer to Milwaukee's downtown, but the west side is mountain bike paths and really is something that you feel like you're miles and miles away from the city's heart, but you're actually, it begins about a mile and a half from downtown. So I look at around the country, who has that? What city of Milwaukee's size has that so close? So urban wilderness is it's a real virtue, and that's something that Milwaukee has done right, done very well in more recent years.
Yeah, for sure. And Lincoln Park, a gem. Thank you, David, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Tom in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Well, I just wanted to mention, hi, John. And
hi, Tom.
About ice skating on the Menominee River. When I was a kid in the 50s, we used to go from down around the Wauwatosa Village. My grandmother lived at the end of 72nd Street, and we went right by Hart Park, and we'd either go down east towards Milwaukee, towards the downtown, or out towards Capitol Drive, and, I mean, you could just skate all over. And the Honey Creek came in there, and that was usually some of the best skating, because there wasn't so much water, and on Menominee, you had to be careful, because there could be thin ice or no ice.
Did you ever break through?
No. generally, you know, it wasn't that bad. You could, if you watched along the shore, you could always hit a rock or jump off on a rock and onto the shoreline and then
go right back on it.
Oh, that's not good for your skates, though.
You know, it's
I recall we would skate on the Root River down in Hills Corners. I spent part of my years in the south side of the down Hills Corners. And if you have the combination of cold weather and no snow, you'd have ice that was just as clear as glass. I can recall seeing fish underneath the ice surface, which was a pretty powerful experience. Some of the things that we covered in the book, or I covered in the book, was the Milwaukee River from the North Avenue Dam up past Capitol, up to the around Capitol Drive. There was a long impoundment there that's now the Milwaukee River Greenway, but early on was kind of a what I refer to as an in-town up north. It was lined with new clubs, swimming schools, amusement parks, beer gardens, summer homes, and in the wintertime, this is before you have video games and TV. There's one photograph there that just, every time I look at it, it kind of astounds me. It is just chock full of people. The ice is covered with people from a vantage point above the North Avenue Dam for what looks like more than a half mile. You can't even see around the bend. And I can recall talking to some of the older folks, largely gone now, but they would skate from Capitol Drive, race from Capitol Drive down the North Avenue Dam there and back. So it was just thronged in both the summer months and the winter months. So Milwaukee really used that river.
It really did. And as you write about at the time, way back, it was everybody worked a six-day week. So
Right. Yeah,
had one day to do something. And that wasn't enough time to drive up north. You had up the up north right there.
Exactly, and there were no cars to drive up north anyway, so it was, you were pretty much, it was shoe leather or taking the streetcar. So you have, there's some wonderful descriptions. Found some great newspaper accounts about the throng of humanity on the upper river, and it was the pictures of some of the canoeists there. And a summer Sunday in the 1890s, it looks like you almost couldn't get it. You could almost walk across the river on canoes. So it really was very, very popular.
And back to ice for just a minute. You talk in there, and you got a great photo in the book about the dependable supply of ice that gave local breweries an advantage over competitors in warmer climates.
That's right. Before they had mechanical refrigeration, they needed ice to cool the beer while it was aging and keep it cool during the selling months. So back in those early years, until the later 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, when you had the first dependable machines, you pretty much had to have ice that they would harvest from local lakes and rivers, including the Milwaukee River itself, as well as all kinds of lakes around southeastern Wisconsin. And they'd store it insulated, these huge cakes stored between layers of sawdust, of which there was an abundance at the time when there was a lot of millwork going on in Milwaukee, a lot of lumbering going on in the area. And the ice houses were always right next to the lake or the river, and they were insulated with double walls were just filled with sawdust. So that was Cincinnati and St. Louis were the other two cities in the so-called German Triangle, and therefore the other two legs of the brewing triangle in the Midwest back in the 1800s, and it gets pretty hot down there. So Milwaukee had the advantage in those early years because we had true winters. So we may think they're kind of an inconvenience today, but they were a competitive advantage back in the 1800s.
And when you had guys, the Germans, like Blatz and Pabst and Schlitz,
right.
And you write about an interesting thing that I hadn't read about before, and that was the Chicago had a brewing industry going, but the Chicago fire kind of took it out.
Yeah, that's right. The fire of 1871 destroyed, I think it was 5 of the 12 Chicago brewers. So they lost almost half their capacity, and Milwaukee's brewers were only too happy to jump into that vacuum and satisfy Chicago's thirst. So by the 90s, they were sending a whole train, 25 car trains filled with ice-cooled beer traveling between Milwaukee and Chicago every single day of the week. So that became a huge market for Milwaukee and really helped the Milwaukee brewers kind of graduate from satisfying a prodigious local thirst to being truly national brewers. They moved on from Chicago to all around the entire country. It was such a big market for Schlitz that one of the Eline brothers, the family who owned the brewery, He moved to Chicago, and he became the head of that market, and that was more than a full-time job. And today you can tell what that lineage is because the Chicago family call themselves U-Line, and the Milwaukee family calls themselves E-Line. So that's where the U-Line company comes from. That's the Chicago E-Line.
It's great stories. Let's take another call. Mary in Menominee, I think, is up next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up in Whitefish Bay in the late 50s, early 60s, and we lived about six blocks from Lake Michigan. And I remember fondly the lake effect snowstorms that would come to school, and we would sled down the center of Hampton Avenue because it was so deep.
Probably wouldn't want to sled down the hill there at Doctors Park or Clody. You could hurt yourself. Yeah, that's one of the things, and certainly Buffalo feels it more than we do because you get those westerly winds and it just drives, you know, all that very moisture-laden water. It gets cold and all that snow just dumps. But those are my favorite snows in the eastern Wisconsin, and when you get kind of that light east wind and those huge fluffy flakes, you know, that's sort of the stuff of kind of Christmas songs and postcards.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary, thank you so much. Let's go to Judy in Mount Sterling. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I am enjoying the show so very much. I used to live in Milwaukee. I have a comment.
Mount Sterling.
Pardon me?
Place around Gaze Mills, Bell Center.
What?
Part of the state.
No. I can't take so many coincidences in one day. I have one comment and one question. You talk about a dependable supply of ice and beer in Milwaukee. There was also a dependable supply of smelt. I remember my stepfather, born in Norway, did smelt fishing with nets off a pier in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, came us kids had to clean the smelts.
Yeah. They were pretty easy, though. Just take a scissors and lop off the heads, right?
Well, and we slit them open and as best we could and used our thumbnail to clean out the innards. But it was
you were a little fussier than some of us.
And my question is, back to Jones Island for a moment. I have an original etching. Don't ask me where it is in my house. It's been packed away for years. But it is of Jones Island when it was a fishing village.
Yep.
Can you tell me what year that might have been or years?
Absolutely. It was a group called the Kashubes who were from what's now the north central seacoast of Poland. My family's Kashub, but we were from the farming region, and along the Baltic Sea they were fishermen, and they still are fisher folk, men and women. And they began to arrive in about 1872. A man named Jacob Muzha, M-U-Z-A, was kind of the godfather there. And they stayed until the land was condemned in 1914. And actually, they stayed to the 1920s when the city was rearranging the island and growing it for the sewage treatment plant in the outer harbor. And the last one to leave was a fisherman named Captain Felix Struck, S-T-R-U-C-K. And he claimed to be the first child born on the island and was the last to leave. And it was a little kind of the western edge of the island, which is now called Kashubes Park, which is about the size of a basketball court. It's the smallest park in Milwaukee. And he was removed in 1943. This was during World War II, when a lot of the munitions and material were being shipped out to the harbor, Milwaukee Harbor. So he was removed for reasons of what they described as port security. He wasn't hurting anybody. They kicked him off the island, and he died, I think, just a couple of months later. So, the site of his settlement is now that little park, and every year it would have happened, first weekend of August, just last weekend, that they'll draw the descendants of the islanders to share genealogy and photographs and kind of renew acquaintances. So it really is a very unique landmark in Milwaukee. And if there's I sometimes ask people, you know, if you did kind of a Milwaukee IQ or Milwaukee trivia quiz, how many people have been, say, if I'm at a talk to Jones Island and seen Kashub's Park? And if they raise their hands, that means they've been paying some attention.
There you go. Oh, man. Judy, you're going to have to take a look at John's book, because there's a lot of really cool information there about Jones Island in his book. Thank you for calling.
Another question that she was referring to the smelt, Larry. You know,
yeah.
Milwaukee,
oh, yeah.
Wisconsin. You talk about schmelt. You know, you sort of the Germanic pronunciation. They're actually an invasive species. They begin to arrive in 1923 from the East Coast, and they're ones that adapted and became hugely popular. And it was a rite of early spring. I always recall it because it was always the first game or two of softball season.
Yeah.
You know, go down, play ball, and then go down and fish with friends. It was in many cases an excuse to drink beer. So it was a real rite of spring. And that population really crashed in the 1990s. And the run, I think there's still an active run on Lake Superior, but the run in Milwaukee is pretty well over. You know, as all the damage we've done to that lake over the years.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad in a way. I have many fond memories of. Beheading.
Yeah, right. I think the ritual was the first kid, you know, the first kid come down there, and the first smelt of the season had to bite their head off. That was the rite of spring.
Oh, man. Thanks again, Judy. Let's go to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Larry and John.
Hi.
I have family living in the Cedarburg area, and a couple of years ago when I was visiting them, there was a Milwaukee Journal article that covered several pages extensively about all these streams and rivers north of Milwaukee that feed into Milwaukee. And I was looking around the house here a little while ago if I retained that article, but I can't find it. And I was wondering if you had any part in that. And also, I want to congratulate you on the series you did for public television called The Making of Milwaukee.
Oh, thank you.
I think I watched it several times from beginning to end. Giving that historical background was just so informational. And also, these people on Jones Island, they're written up by Ann Gernick, in her book, and these are the people from hell. And if you look in that northern part of Poland, there's this little piece of land that stretches out in the ocean, and it's called hell. And it's very similar to the little patch of land they took over in Jones Island.
Yeah, it's called the Hell Peninsula, and it's spelled H-E-L. My wife and I were there probably 10, 12 years ago, and you get to the end of town, and there's a sign saying "Vitami to Hell," so welcome to hell, basically. And they don't see the irony, you know. They're obviously not speaking English.
And you can say you've been to hell and back.
You've been to hell and back. That's right. That's right. So that's a very picturesque, very gorgeous part of Poland. Thanks for the praise for the Making of Milwaukee series. We updated that about 3 years ago, and for the 10th anniversary, and that's. They don't stream that, but it's called Making Milwaukee the Next Chapter. So we felt the need to update that for the 10-year anniversary. Right now we're working on a curriculum for all the schools in southeastern Wisconsin, the Milwaukee market. So that remains a very active project. In terms of the river project, the Milwaukee River watershed extends all the way up into Fond du Lac County and certainly includes all the northern Kettle Moraine. I mean, it's not certainly not the Wisconsin or the Mississippi, but it's the most important stream in southeastern Wisconsin. And if you look at the rivers in all over the state, and you kind of run from the Chicago up to, you know, Waukegan, the Pike in Kenosha, the Root in Racine, the Milwaukee in Milwaukee, wherever you have a river mouth is where the city's developed. And that really underlines the fundamental importance of water transportation in those early years. That's why all those towns exist, including Cornucopia up in Bayfield, the fishing settlement in Gills Rock and Door County. You know, so it really was very much a formative influence.
Did you have any, Patricia wondered if you had any influence or any part of the article about the rivers and streams feeding into Milwaukee
No, that wasn't me. The other people have covered the same waterfront.
So to speak. Oh, man.
The puns are endless.
You know, we talked about Cream City Brick in one of my shows this last week, and I really enjoyed it. I was able to bring your book in that discussion because I learned a little bit from you in reading about how that brick came to be cream, and talk about that, cream-colored.
It's actually, they're lake deposits. You know, you have all this sort of ground rock from the glacial period, you know, which ended not that long ago, you know, 10,000 years ago. And the bedrock in eastern Wisconsin, you know, it's that dolomite, which has, it's a magnesium-rich limestone, so it's got a lot of calcium and a lot of magnesium. And those chemicals, it's very simply a matter of chemistry and how those were laid down by water and fine particles. And you have these beds of clay, and it runs from northeastern Illinois all the way up to around Green Bay. And you have these very thick deposits of clay that when they mined it and formed it and fired it, it produced this very pleasant kind of a pale yellow colored brick. Early on, the pioneers were a bit disappointed that they didn't get the red brick like they were used to from back east, you know, which has a high iron content, you know, which is not in the eastern Wisconsin's bedrock. But it turned out they had a rather rare commodity that was so attractive for building purposes that they were at one point shipping it as far away as Europe. So Milwaukee became known as the Cream City, not because it's the metropolis of America's Dairyland, but because it is so many of the public buildings were built with this local brick, and they haven't made it in decades, but it's still, when you polish that up, restored, it's just gorgeous, really, really glows.
It is really, really beautiful. And John Freiberger, my guest that day, said, by the way, you can tell, I think he's pretty good at telling where a brick was made just by its color, because the bricks around the state are often quite different.
Sure, sure. All chemistry.
It's all chemistry. Well, John, I got to tell you, I always you were with Kathleen Dunn on many shows, and I was always sad that I couldn't interview you. So I'm really glad to had a chance to read your book and look at the wonderful photos and your great writing. Thank you so much for being with us today to talk about your book, Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. John, thanks.
A pleasure to be with you, Larry.
John Gerda is the author, Milwaukee, A City Built on Water. Great to have him, and I hope I have a chance to talk with him again. He really knows his stuff when it comes to Milwaukee and a whole lot of other things as well. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about helping your child with issues that relate to going back to school. That's coming up. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.